first pitch, I'm up there first pitch, and whoosh, here comes a curveball. And I started giggling. Then the catcher looks up and he goes, "What are you laughing at?" I said, "The Express is throwing me curveballs." You know, there are a lot of people that don't necessarily want to have all the spotlights on them. They don't want to have the bat when the game's on the line, stuff like that. That's what I lived for. That's the situation I wanted to be in.
On April 8th, 1986, you were 22 when you broke into the big leagues with the Giants. And your first hit, which we're going to get into in a little bit, was off some pitcher named Nolan Ryan. But before we go there, I want to take people back a little further. In 85, you were drafted second overall by the Giants. And we need to validate a couple things. Our intern saying your first minor league bat in Fresno was a home run.
That's correct.
And then our intern is also saying your first spring training at bat in 1986 was also a home run.
That's correct.
My question, drafted in 85, spring training in 86, did you have an idea that you had a shot at making the ball club going into that spring training?
Not really. You know, I mean, I got drafted in 85 and went to Fresno, which was our high A affiliate at the time. And Fresno had been floundering around. Myself, our second round draft choice, his name was Brian Anuka. He's a right-handed starter. And then my teammate at Mississippi State was our number 8 pick. In the 8th round was Jeff Brantley. So the three of us all went to Fresno together, and it was just a magical fit. We turned the whole team around. We went 50-15 in the second half, and we wound up winning the Cal League title. I go to Instructional League that fall. So in September and October, I go to Instructional League, and I'm winning the Triple Crown because we were playing against other organizations. I'm winning the Triple Crown, and the Giants sent me home. They said, "That's it. You've had enough baseball, go home." I came back the following year, 1986, to spring training on basically a AAA contract. I was a non-roster player, and I think that they just wanted to see what I could do. The other first baseman that was there was Dan Dreesen, who was the old Big Red's machine first baseman, and it was just one of those things. I mean, Dan was having a rough go of it during spring training, and I was leading the Cactus League in the Triple Crown again, and Roger Craig and Al Rosen gave me the job, and I was like, whoa. I said, that was a very, very quick rise to the top.
Definitely was. Well,
I got to ask you to tell the exact time, the first time you knew from Roger Craig, from his mouth, that you were going to be the first baseman, because I think it's a pretty
funny story. All right, so that's a story unto itself. So, I got like a little mini pulled hammy. It's not killing me, but then again, I'm babying it a little bit. And it just so happened that day, I'm 3-for-3 and I'm standing on second base in spring training. And the third base coach goes, "Hey, come off the field." And I'm like, "No." And he goes, "You got to come off the field." I said, "No, I ain't coming off the field." And then I look over and Roger Craig's going, come here like this. And I'm like, "No." And so finally he gets up out of his chair and he's like, "Come here." And so I went in off the field, and he says, "Meet me in my office." And we literally went straight down and went into his office. Now, this is during the game. And he goes, "Don't you ever show me up out on the field. I'm the manager of San Francisco Giants, blah, 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 blah." I said, "Don't you ever try to take me out of a game when I'm 3-for-3. I'm locked in." And he looked at me like this. He goes, "Well, if you're going to be my first baseman," he says, "you need to listen to me." And I go, wait. "Your first baseman?" He goes, "Yes." He says, "You are my first baseman." I go, "Oh my God, yes, I will do whatever you say." So that's kind of how I became a San Francisco Giant in 1986.
The aforementioned first AB in the majors, first major league game. For those that are on this channel, probably have heard the name of the got too many nicknames. What was your favorite nickname? Mr. Ryan.
It was just the Express back in the day. I mean, you know, I'm I'm from New Orleans, and Houston was right there, and they just called him the Express, so that's what we called him.
So the story goes, or I guess, Will, we'll let you tell the story, because I want to know about that first pitch and what's going through your head, and I think there was a story there, but we got also a video to support it.
Yeah, we'll get into it all. So, you know, come up there first at bat, you know, I mean, you know, just shaking in your pants like you would. You know, it didn't matter who you were. You first major league at bat, and it just so happens it's off of Nolan Ryan. It's like, oh, Jesus. And, you know, I talked to some of my veterans on the bench beforehand. They said, you know, he likes to throw fastballs away. So I was like, all right, that's cool. That sort of kind of fits into the game plan that I thought I'd have. And first pitch, I'm up there first pitch, and here comes a curveball. And I kind of like buckled, but I saw the ball the whole way pretty good. And I started giggling, and I was like, you know, one of these numbers. And the catcher looks up, and he goes, what are you laughing at? I said, the Express is throwing me curveballs. So the next pitch was a fastball. He missed up and away with it. And then the third pitch was a fastball. I mean, it was right there. And I caught it out in front. When I hit it, it made just this god-awful sound. When you hit a baseball and you catch it absolutely square, I mean, it just reverberates, and you know, especially in the Astrodome. And so I was like, man, I caught that one pretty good. But when I was running around first, I was like, no way, this ball going out of here. And it went out of center field in the Astrodome. I'm like, whoa, you know, one of these kind of numbers. And touch home plate and pointed to my family up in the stands and, you know, high-fived everybody, the whole works. And then I'm sitting on the bench after everything sort of kind of settled down. This, like, calm came over me. And I looked at Chili Davis. He's sitting right next to me. I go, he's going to drill me next time up. He goes, oh, hell yeah. he's in his windup the next at bat, and I'm already kind of going to the ground.
So I want to stay in Houston and talk about Mike Scott, who in 1986, he was the Cy Young winner. And I got a little story. So my friend Peter, we'll just call him Peter from the Bay Area, big Giants fan, rips up all his Astros baseball cards, comes in the middle room to his parents crying. He's like, Mom, Mike Scott is cheating and they won't do anything about it. So my question to you is, like, what did the team think of Mike Scott in the 1986 era? If, as a kid, my friend Peter was crying and knew what was going on.
All right, so here you go. So here's your story within the story.
And by the way, I Googled Mike Scott, and it is his birthday today.
Oh, wow. Happy birthday, Mike. There you go. Well, Mike Scott, believe it or not, was a disciple of Roger Craig. Mike had been scuffling a little bit, and Roger Craig's the one that taught him the split finger. And so not only did he teach him the split finger, he probably taught him a few other things. And so, you know, there's at one point, you know, we're playing in Candlestick. We're playing against the Astros. And we got like 16 or 17 baseballs on the bench. And they all got the scuff in exactly the same spot on the ball, right? And none of these balls have even hit the ground. So where do you think these are coming from? And so anyway, so Roger Craig's yelling at me from the dugout. I'm up at the plate, you know, and he's like, check the ball. First pitch comes, and I don't say a word. He's like, check the ball, check the ball. Second pitch comes, check the ball. He's screaming at me. And I turned around to him. I said, I know he's cheating. He knows he's cheating. The whole everybody in here knows he's cheating. I'm just not going to wear one in the ear when I check this ball. So, so needless to say, Roger Craig got thrown out that game. He came out there, threw all the baseballs on the field, the whole world. Mike Scott was unbelievable. I mean, he threw a legitimate 94-95. He was cutting it up so the ball would ride in on you, kind of like a Mariano Rivera, you know, that kind of thing. And then he had this unbelievable split finger to go with it. And, you know, they won the division title. And in winning the division title, he threw a no-hitter, and it was against us. It was against San Francisco, and I made the last out of that no-hitter.
Sticking with the Astros, so there's a theme here. You hit your first home run in your first at bat in the minors home run at spring training, home run against some guy named Nolan Ryan. You go back to Candlestick.
First time we witnessed the Astros cheating, too. We got to throw that out there.
But we go back to Candlestick, and it's your first game in the Bay Area at Candlestick. A home run on your first at-bat at Candlestick. Is that correct?
No, it was my third at-bat, but I got one in the first game.
So what was it like playing in front of the hometown fans at Candlestick for the first time?
It was pretty incredible. I mean, you know, after we opened up on the road in Houston and wherever else we went, we came back. And this is the way it was. I mean, you know, you'd go on the road, and let's say you played three teams. Let's say you played Atlanta, Pittsburgh, Philly. Well, then you turn around and those three teams would come to you. And that's just the way it was back then. And so, you know, we open up there at the Stick, and, you know, we got a jam-packed house, and, you know, all of my teammates are like, wow. And I'm like, what? I'm like, this is pretty cool. And they're like, no, you don't get it. There were like 2,500 people here last year. It was like nobody in the stands, and we had kind of a packed house. So it was pretty neat, you know, not only for myself to see it, but also my teammates too. So, hey, while I'm talking to you guys about it, because, you know, you guys went over the features and all that sort of stuff. You got a chat feature, and Ron Anderson just asked any questions about playing in Fresno. I got one for you playing in Fresno. So, you know, okay. I go to Fresno. I'm in Fresno for 3 months. This is about our third or fourth game. So I'm new to the ball club. The opposing hitter hits a nubber off the end of the bat, and it's in between myself and the pitcher, and we're going for it. And the pitcher beats me to the ball, and he goes and he tags the runner. Well, instead of tagging him just like in the shoulder or whatever, he hit him upside the head. So the runner don't even get to first base. He turns around and whammo, here we go. We got a brawl right here. I'm like, oh, Jesus, really? I'm like, my third or fourth game in pro ball here, right? So it just so happened that the hitter had his back to me. So I grabbed him around the back like this. Well, unbeknownst to me, we're right in front of the visitor's dugout. And the guy came out. He wound up being their catcher. He caught me from behind with a sucker punch right here. And down goes Frazier. I'm talking about I was out cold, right? And all this craziness goes on, right? And at the end of the year for Fresno, they put on like a little team party and all that. They had the wham and we had that on a loop, and it kept playing over and over. So all you see is wham, Will down, wham, Will down. I was like, nice job, guys. Nice job.
Another WST first, the first time Will gets cold clocked by a catch.
Oh, I mean, I got pulverized. I was out cold. See ya.
All right, if we have any more questions, chime in. Will, I want to talk a little more about Candlestick, because you've come out and said that the winds were, I mean, if you were in a dome, let me ask you this. You think you would have had a few more home runs versus playing at Candlestick?
Oh, yeah, without a shadow of a doubt. Matter of fact, believe it or not, we just got through talking about that in spring training. I just got back from spring training with the minor leaguers in Arizona and watching some of the wind-blown balls and the infielders, you know, drifting and dropping pop flies and stuff like that. And it brought to mind, you know, the Stick, and we shot pop-ups every day in spring training. And it wasn't necessarily to catch the ball as much as we were working on communication. And I asked, you know, some of the veterans that, you know, you guys know, and I'm like, why are we shooting pop-ups every day? They go, wait till we get to the Stick. And I'm like, okay. And so, you know, we get there, and the first pop-up goes up, and we literally have like four people chasing it. And all four of us are talking at the same time. We're like, you got it? No, I'm not there yet. And the whole time we're running. And that's how we got our communication going. We got to be like really good, you know, catching fly balls at home. And then the other teams would come in, and it was just a cluster. I mean, they had so many problems. I mean, Gerald Perry was the first baseman with the Braves. I remember he comes in, and, you know, because first base and second base was sun fields. So you had to drop the glasses and you had to get your glove up. You know, otherwise you lose track of the ball, or the ball would stay in the sun or whatever. And Gerald, I mean, he didn't have either. And he got hit twice in the head in one three-game set. You know, I'm like, Gerald, could you please get a glove on it? You're making us first baseman look bad over here, dude. You're killing me.
So how did your hitting approach evolve, I guess, from your time in Candlestick? You said, I think at one point, you were traded for Mattingly. At some point, you would add a few more home runs because of the pesky pull out in New York.
Yeah.
So what's kind of the approach you took in some of the things you learned playing on that ball field?
You know, you kind of just took advantage of, you know, the pitches that were presented to you. There was no rhyme or reason about the stick. I mean, I'm telling you that right now. I mean, you know, you'd be at home plate sometimes, you're looking at center field and the center field flags are blowing at one another. You're like, really, seriously? And, you know, there were some nights you couldn't hit a cannon out of left field. There were other nights the ball flew out of left field. Same thing with right. You know, you'd catch all of one to right field and you're like, I got this one. And the right fielder's running in on it. And then the next day you catch one, you're like, all right, I got it pretty good. And it went out about 40 rows. So, you know, there was kind of no rhyme or reason about the stick. And, you know, people ask me, you know, how much did it cost you guys? And for the guys who played there all the time, you know, I mean, you're talking about 81 games there. I told them, I said, it probably cost you at least 5 to 10 homers and maybe 20, 25 RBIs. I mean, just balls that you caught like really good that you knew if you were on the road, you had some action.
Yeah.
What was your fondest memory of Candlestick?
Oh, my goodness. You know, believe it or not, I mean, you got so many memories playing, but believe it or not, it was the fans. You'd have guys in, you know, swimming trunks and the cutoff T-shirts, you know, and girls would be out there in bikinis, you know, like during batting practice, right? But they walked down with this freaking huge-ass bag. And I'm like, what the hell's going on? You know, and then we called it the Hawk. About 4 or 4:30 every afternoon, that wind would start kicking up. There was a big hawk down the right field line. He had this nest in the right one of the right field light towers. And he'd get up, and he wouldn't even flap his wings. He'd get up, and he'd just start hovering around. We're like, uh-oh, here it comes. And about that time, you know, the wind would start kicking up, and all of those people coming in with the bathing suits and the cutoff shirts and all that, they'd open up their bags, and they'd get these freaking ski suits and that stuff that went on their head. And I'm like, oh, God, these are serious veterans. They know what the hell is going on here. So it was fun. It was fun dealing with fans. It was a lot of fun.
We had Will Venable. He said, you're not the only one to say the San Fran fans were the highlight of that stadium. I think he loved playing there because the fans always had some zingers. You hear any good ones in your time at Candlestick?
Oh, there was some great ones. I mean, I can't zero on exactly one, but I mean, you know, Tommy Lasorda would come out that right field because right field had a set of doors, and that's where the visiting clubhouse was. And he'd have to walk all the way down the right field line, all the way into the dugout. And they were just, I mean, letting him have it. And he's blowing and kissing. Oh, my God. It's beautiful. And then, like, Kirk Gibson, after a three-game set against the Dodgers, you know, he was out there in left field after a three-game set. I would, on purpose, because I always shagged in right field. But I'd go over to left field just to see, and I mean, there's oranges, batteries, probably $5 worth of quarters. I mean, it was just getting pummeled out there. So, the stick was a very unique place. And then, I forgot about it. Before they had the bleachers out there in left field, if we did hit a homer, you know, out of left or left center or whatever it was, the stands were back. And I'm talking about like a pretty good ways. I mean, like 30 or 40 yards. And all of these fans would bail out of the stands, and it was a rugby scrum for the home run ball. And it was hysterical. I mean, there's fights going on out there, everything else. And it was like an attraction unto itself. We'd have to stop the game and watch the rugby scrum going on out there.
Well, I also remember because of the wind, you would get all the trash just like blowing around and by the chain link fence. And then someone would hit a home run, and it would be like a wrestling match out there and left.
That's a great one right there, Kyle. You know, some of the guys, you know, who know me well, they go, what did you miss about the stick? What do you miss about the stick? And I said, you know, it's a little sadistic to say this. I said, but I miss the fact that you had 100 freaking hot dog wrappers blowing around. You're up there and you're like, all right, one of them has to be the baseball. Which one? That was just a game unto itself. It was amazing.
All right, Will, we got a question from one of our fans. Your fans. Having starred in the Olympics as an amateur in 84, would you prefer Team USA to be comprised of amateurs or pros at the next Olympics?
I think it works out great being amateur wise. A pro is kind of used to all of the adulation and all that craziness. I think, you know, being a college player in 84, I appreciated it more. You know, we walked out, we were right there with the basketball team when we walked out in the Coliseum in LA in 84. And I mean, that place was going crazy. And I still, till this day, I get the hair stand up on the back of my neck thinking about it, you know, just 100,000 people chanting USA. And I mean, they were going crazy, and you get Michael Jordan in front of you. I mean, it was a great experience in a college guy's, you know, life. And I think that if you did it with pro guys, it would sort of kind of dilute it.
Amen. You still stay in touch with any of those guys from the Olympic team? I think you said that a lot of them got drafted, right?
Yeah.
Obviously, a bunch of them
got drafted. Matter of fact, most all of them, believe it or not, first round picks. But, you know, Bobby Witt was a teammate of mine in Texas, so I was able to talk to Bobby a lot. Mark McGuire was first baseman. I actually played left, believe it or not. But Big Mac and I have stayed in touch throughout the years. You know, we played against each other, San Francisco and Oakland, and we played on the same team, you know, in St. Louis later in my career. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I've kept in a fair amount of good touch with these guys.
The 85 draft, I mean, some people say it's top three. Some people say it's the best of all time.
Yeah.
Was Smoltz in that?
Who was now? I'm sorry.
Was it John Smoltz? Was John Smoltz, B.J. Surhoff? You mentioned Barry.
Before.
No, Barry Larkin.
Take it back. It was. I don't know. You're probably right because you would know it better than I do. But so B.J. Surhoff was the number one pick in the country. You know, we came off the Olympic team, and he wanted to be the number one pick. So he actually signed a few weeks before the draft. And then I was number two. Barry was number three. Bobby Witt was number four. And then a little bit later in the round was Chris Gwynn, Tony Gwynn's brother, who was also on the Olympic team. So we had, you know, the first four picks were all ex-Olympic guys, and then one down the road. And then you had Incaviglia was in there, and Rafael Palmeiro was in there. So, I mean, you know, the 85 draft was pretty stacked.
So it was Barry Larkin and Barry Bonds, both of them.
No. Barry Larkin was on the Olympic team. Barry Bonds, he was at ASU, and he actually went later in the draft.
Got it.
He was first round, but I don't know what pick he was.
So you're thinking that Olympics did a lot probably for a lot of those guys' draft status. Back to the amateurs, right?
It did a lot.
That could mean the difference.
A lot for, yeah, not only that draft class that you're talking about, but it also did a lot for the next draft classes coming up because they instituted it. It was a demonstration sport when we did it, but then they instituted it as a gold medal sport. And so, you know, guys were kind of upping their game to try to make the Olympic team, much less get drafted.
Might have to change your name to Mr. First, because you were on your first home run in every park. You stayed in first Olympics. I mean, that had to be a lot of fun.
Here's another one, Ben. My last at-bat in the big leagues. See you later. I'm out of here.
Mr. First and Mr. Last.
Hey, some guys, you know, hey, there's been a lot of people that have talked to me about this. And it's just, it was my mindset. It was my aggressiveness, however you want to call it. There are a lot of people that don't necessarily want to have all the spotlights on them. They don't want to have the bat when the game's on the line, stuff like that. That's what I lived for. That's the situation I wanted to be in. I did not want to come up to home plate and have nobody on, nobody out. I wanted to have two runners on, and, you know, you get a base hit, and you move around, you set them up for the next guy, or if you get a pitch to handle, whammo, you kick one out the yard, you know, whatever. You know, another thing, too, is a lot of guys get caught up in the moment, that you know, that exhilaration that you feel. They don't know how to control that. And, you know, kind of like that first at bat in the big leagues that we talked about with Nolan. Yeah, I'm fired up, right? But the best thing in the world he did was throw me that curveball. Man, that let me settle down. I saw the ball the whole way. I'm like, all right, this is another, just another guy I'm facing. That I'm, now, granted, it's getting up there a lot quicker, but this is another guy like I've been facing through my whole life, all right? And it let me settle the whole situation down. Another thing, too, is when you have the big crowds and stuff like that, everybody takes in the whole moment. Whereas for me personally, I zeroed it up. So, you know, everybody's going crazy. Everybody's going insane. It's me and the pitcher, and I'm just trying to pick up that ball out of his hand and tattoo the hell out of it. That was it. So, you know, those kind of things come into play as you, you know, get along down the line, as you get a little further in your career.
Thank God for that curveball.
Yep. You're right.
If we stick with 1986, man. We have the 86 Mets, who actually, they won the World Series, I believe, that year. And now you're facing Dwight Gooden in his prime. What was it like going up in a head-to-head battle against Dwight Gooden?
You know, first time I faced Dwight, you know, I mean, I'd seen him on TV and stuff like that, but I really didn't know much about him. And, you know, I knew fastball, you know, over-the-top curveball. And I remember going up there, and the first fastball that I saw, you know, I mean, I just got through facing Nolan, so, I mean, you know, big deal, fastball. But he put it right on the outside corner, knee high, and it was like absolutely nothing I could do with it. And then the next pitch was exactly the same pitch, and now I'm in the hole 0-2, and I'm like, Jesus, he hadn't made a mistake by like an inch, you know, and it's at 95 on top of that. So, I mean, it was like, whoa, you know, this guy's got really good stuff. And, you know, you guys probably know, you know, the 30 for 30 special or yeah, whatever it was. I mean, you know, needless to say, he and Strawberry had, you know, few little problems, as did, you know, some other guys that, you know, I either played against or played with or whatever. You know, it was just at the time, it was an honor to face a competitor like that. And it's kind of, I mean, I hate to say it, but it's kind of, you know, sad to see what happened to him later on down the road.
Yeah, definitely.
Will, we got another question. This might be a little long-winded, but I put the KC hat back on, and before
I see it. Yeah.
We came on. It's been said you were a Kansas City fan growing up, and you actually got drafted by them fourth round as an amateur or high schooler coming out. My first question to you is, why didn't you sign with them coming out of high school?
So that's a great question. So I was in the same draft class as Brett Saberhagen. He was a number one pick. I was a number four pick. And I think number three was Steve Balboni. So we were in that class together. I basically, during the negotiations, first off, I had never been away from home. So now you're talking about, you know, an 18-year-old kid, never been away from home, going into pro ball and going into some league somewhere across the country. So that came into effect. But then I wanted them to, you know, kind of reimburse me for a college education, which is what I would be giving up if I signed with them, and they would not do that. So it kind of made my decision a little bit easier, and I wound up going to Mississippi State. I was 4 hours away from home. So I could get off on my own. I could grow up, become a man. I was playing in the SEC for Ron Polk, who was one of the deans of college baseball at the time. And we had a top five club all 3 years I was at Mississippi State. You know, went to the World Series, played in a lot of big baseball games. And so that in itself, and on top of that, I was able to try out for the Olympic team, go to the 84 Olympics. Those experiences in itself, those 3 years at Mississippi State, actually got me ready for pro ball. And so even though I really appreciate, you know, the Kansas City Royals and all that, it just, in the grand scheme of things, looking back, it was the best decision I ever made. And to expound on what you were talking about as far as Kansas City goes, was I really enjoyed those guys because I was a George Brett fan. I mean, just watching him hit was like poetry in motion, and I loved it.
Now, the question is, what other schools recruited you? You're from New Orleans. LSU come to mind. They're in the SEC.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Good school.
I'm seeing the question. Yeah.
Who was number two? Who was left at the altar?
LSU did not have that good of a program back then, and so they were kind of out of the running. The program that was pretty darn good, believe it or not, was University of New Orleans. They had been in the College World Series, and it was my sophomore year. They went to the College World Series. They had Augie Schmidt, who was a Golden Spikes Award winner. They played a good brand of baseball. I liked them a lot. But it goes back to what we were talking about before. I mean, I'm playing against guys I've been playing against since I'm 8 years old. I didn't want that. I wanted different competition so I could get better. And so, I got recruited by everybody, Texas, Oklahoma State, Arkansas, Miami. You know, it was just, you know, in a boatload of small schools, it was just what kind of fit perfect. And Mississippi State had an opening at first base and, you know, a legitimate program. Now, when I went to Mississippi State, Ron Polk happened to put an outfielder. He was a senior outfielder. He put him at first base. And so I'd come in late in the game for defensive purposes and do some pitch hitting and stuff like that. And then about maybe two-thirds of the way through the season, he busted up a thumb. And it just so happened that I got a start against Auburn at Auburn. And I hit a homer in both games at a doubleheader and kind of Wally pipped him and never looked back.
All right, well, this is a good question for No Filter Network. When the Giants won the West in 87, there's a few fans that apparently distinctly remember you dropping an F-bomb with a reporter on live TV.
Not one F-bomb, probably a bunch.
When was the first time you dropped an F-bomb, and what were the ramifications?
All right, so the reporter's name was Gary Park, all right? And the cameras had never been allowed in the clubhouse before then live. Evidently, it was taped, and you could edit it and all that. I didn't know that 87 is the first time that they're live. So I'm in there screaming and yelling. I'm freaking squirting champagne all over, and I dropped the F-bomb a few times. I've been waiting a fucking long time for this. You know what I mean? I'm out there screaming and yelling and shooting shit all over the place. I was chewing gum. I almost swallowed that. You know, the whole works. I'm having a ball. And, as is San Francisco, you had to go out and apologize the next day and all that. I get called in the office by Roger Craig. He said, you got to make a public apology, which I did. And then it actually wound up being a great thing because like four people wanted me to apologize, but like 45,000 were like, that's the best thing. That's the kind of energy we need. We need more people like that. And I was like, all right, let's go. Let's go. So, I watched my P's and Q's a little bit more after that, but it didn't tamper down that emotional side of me.
All right. Speaking of emotional side, we got one more video, Will.
Yeah, all we right. talked a little bit about fights early on at Fresno. We're going to talk about another right. fight Take later it on.
Baby. Take it on.
Before we get all into right. the fight, can you talk a little bit about Cardinals versus Giants at that time?
So, you know, I mean, you had Whitey Herzog, you know, was the manager of the Cardinals, and Roger Craig, and they were two old schoolers, and they went at one another. And then, you know, you get, you know, St. Louis, who, you know, stole a lot of bases, had a great, you know, pitching staff. And then you get San Francisco. We're trying to be up and comers, and we're trying to be kind of like the Cardinals had been for their whole, you know, careers, I guess you want to say, or, you know, franchise history. And so this actually, believe it or not, got precipitated the night before. Vince Coleman, we were losing 7-0, and we were playing behind him at first base in like the eighth inning, and he stole second and third. And so we were like, we're going to get you. And then this happened the next day.
All right. We did this with you, Will, and we need you to You need to do a little play-by-play. What's going on? All right,
so I already know I'm at first base. I already know if Candy hits a grounder, I'm gonna go get somebody. All right. And the rule was all you had to do is be able to touch second, which I did as I went by it. And I was trying to initiate contact, which I did. So bingo, here you go.
He kicks you.
He kicked me, and then I'm getting up, and then he hit me in the helmet, and then all hell breaks loose. Boom. There's one. There's another one. He gets out of my grasp. I get him again. Wham! I get him again going to the ground. Ozzy's sucker punching everybody like he normally does. And then here comes Candy Maldonado. Why can't take Ozzy out?
The left.
All right. So now you guys don't see this now. All right. So now, after this, because Candy cleaned out Ozzy, Bob Brenly comes in from the bullpen, and he must have hit Ozzy 10 times. I don't know. Dusty Baker's right there. 12 is Dusty Baker. He's right in the middle of it. it's hysterical. This was a good one. This was
there's Kevin Mitchell.
I mean, everybody got involved. There's Brenly and Ozzy after Brenly's hit him about 15 times. Chris Spire. They had all kinds of good ones there.
Oh, Willie McGee.
So now the best part is I got ejected. I'm the one that got hit. How the hell did I get ejected? How did he? Oh, yeah, he's wiping his face because he's bloody right there. Anyway, funny follow-up story that is. I get traded over to, you know, St. Louis later in my career, and Oquendo is my third base coach. And we go out and we have beers. We're talking just, you know, it's water under the bridge to us, you know, no big deal. Hey, that's the way it was. Ozzy still held a grudge and still till this day does.
So we got another question. Well, what was it like returning as a player, a member of the Rangers when you came back to Kansas State?
Oh, wow. You know, that was pretty good. I mean, I really wanted to, you know, remain a Giant. I wasn't trying to go anywhere, and that's just the way it happened. And, you know, we played the first interleague game in 96 against the Giants at Texas. And, you know, so later in the year we go back and, you know, I remember, you know, getting a warm welcome, but also at the same time, I had a few guys that were ragging on me. Right. And especially one guy, he was right behind the Giants dugout, and I was facing Kirk Reeder. And, you know, I mean, Kirk, needless to say, wasn't a flamethrower. So I was sitting breaking ball, and he threw me a hanging slider. Bam, I got him. And I touched home plate, and I was coming back. And like I said, the guy was right behind the dugout, you know. And I stopped before I got to the dugout. I said, keep ragging on me. I said, I'll hit another homer off of this bastard next time up. And all his buddies around him said, shut up. Don't piss off the thrill. But it was fun going back to San Francisco.
So I want to go back to 1989 NL Championship Series, Giants versus the Cubs. That was when you hit 650, 13 hits and 20 at bats. And oh, by the way, Mark Grace hit 647, and you guys were going toe to toe. What was it like going against Gracie like that? And was it like, anything you do, I'm going to try to top it?
Yeah, you know what? You know what's funny about that was, you know, you get into a situation in baseball where you get locked in. And there are situations like this over the course of the year where, you know, you pull a 8 for 12 and, you know, you're catching everything on the screws and all that. But to have two guys do it in the playoffs when it means the most and going to the World Series and all that sort of stuff, it was pretty magical. And, you know, I'd get a hit. Gracie would get a hit. You know, we were down on first base, being first baseman. We're both talking to each other. I'm like, hey, you again. He goes, yeah, me again. You know, that kind of stuff. And, you know, I told him, I flat out told him, and I think it was game, might have been game 3 or game 4. I don't know. I don't remember which one it was. I told him, I said, you do know that either me or you are going to win this series. And he like looked at me and he had this like puzzled look. I said, I said, it's the way the baseball gods are. I said, either you or I got to come up when it's the game's on the line. And he's like, I get it. And I haven't seen Mark in a long time, but, you know, I guarantee you we'd talk about that conversation. I promise you we would.
So on a similar note, NL Championship Series, Giants Cubs game one, 1989, you hit a grand slam off Mr. Maddux.
Is that where you're going?
There you go. Yeah, reading lips. I was going to put myself on mute and see if you could tell me what I said, but did you read his lips?
Yes, I read his lips. I was looking right at him when he said fastball in like that. But there is a story behind the story, like we keep talking about. You know, it's just it didn't just happen overnight. So first at bat, he goes sinker away, and I get a double in the left center. Next at bat, he threw one or two fastballs away and a bunch of changeups away, and I wound up moving up on a plate, and I hooked a home run out of right center. So now we have two other left-handers in the lineup, Brett Butler and Pat Sheridan, and he is pounding them in. So common sense dictates, sooner or later, I got to see something in, right? So I'm standing in the on-deck circle with Kevin Mitchell, bases loaded, fourth inning, two outs. And I'm looking at Greg Maddux, and Don Zimmer comes out the dugout. And Don, needless to say, is a lot shorter than Greg. And Greg Maddux went fastball in. And if you've ever been to Chicago Wrigley, I mean, you're pretty close to the mound. I mean, you know, I'm looking right at him. So I told Boogie Bear, Kevin Mitchell, I told him, I said, did you see that? He goes, no, what? I said, he said fastball in. He said, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to freaking look fastball in. He goes, all right. And, so I remember walking up to home plate, and I dug my hole like I always do, right? And I backed out the batter's box, and when I got in my hole, I cut it short about 4 inches because I was sitting in there anyway, and the ball wound up being on the inside corner. And that was one of those swings that when you hit it, you go, thank God I didn't miss it because I got exactly the pitch I wanted, exactly where I was looking for it, and did not miss it. And so later on, Kevin Mitchell tells some of our teammates about the, you know, the reading and the lips and all that. And so intern went and told some of the press members. I got a ton of questions about it, and I didn't say a word. And then the next year, everybody and the grandma in spring training are like, they're like this, they're trying to go out to the mound. And I'm like, oh, Jesus, if I'd have known that, I wouldn't have said a damn word to nobody. And then to take that story a step further, right? So now these idiots doing all that, you see them on today's games. I mean, they go out there like that, right? So I'm in double A, and I'm working with some of our hitters and stuff. And one of our catchers goes out to the mound. He's got the hockey mask on. So he's got the thing in the front, and he's got the helmet in the back and all that. He goes out to the mound, and he freaking covers up his face. I'm like, as soon as he got back to the dugout, I'm like, what are you doing? They can't see your mouth. They don't know what the hell's going on. They're like, this kids can't hear you. Like, what are you doing, goofball?
Oh.
So moving on, Bay Bridge World Series. What was that?
Yeah. A lot of fun being out on the field. A lot of giggling and laughing like this, buddy. A lot of it.
So I was bringing up the Bay Bridge World Series, Game 3, October 7th. Game was supposed to start, but there was an earthquake. And then all of a sudden, there was no game. Where were you when you found the news that there was no longer going to be a game due to the earthquake?
I kind of knew it. This is right before introductions. We were running sprints in the outfield. I just got through running a sprint to center, and I was walking back towards the right field line, and it sounded like the F-15s flying over. So I looked up, and right when I looked up, the freaking light towers are going boom, boom. I go, oh, this is not good. And then about that time, you could see the wave came through the stadium, damn near knocked me down. I was standing out there, and, you know, everybody was like, oh, they were kind of freaking out. And then once it subsided, you know, people, the fans in the stands were like, welcome to San Francisco, you know. They were like ready to go, you know. And I get back to the dugout, and the police radios were going off. All the guys that were the dugout were, you know, talking about the Bay Bridge had collapsed and, you know, the Nimitz had collapsed. And then we had some fires in the Marina District and all that. And after a little bit, I guess maybe 15, 20 minutes, you know, I mean, just standing around doing nothing. One of the policemen said, "You're not playing this game." And so first thing I thought about was, you know, mom and dad and my family were up in the stands. They were actually under one of the overhangs and they had never been through an earthquake before. And so I was thinking about getting them off the field, out of the stands. Damn. And that's what happened after they called the game.
Now, there was 10 games between game two when they rescheduled game three. And I know you can never trust the internet, but they were saying they were talking about moving it to another city and then the stadium wasn't going to be ready in time. Like, what were you hearing from the commissioner about when game three was going to be?
You know, as soon as, you know, they were able to get into the stadium, I mean, they started repairs on the stadium because there was a big crack out there in center field. We had some structural issues. So, you know, they were rocking and rolling trying to get it ready. I don't remember any talk about moving the game to a different place or anything. You know, this was game two, game one and game two had been in Oakland. This is game three in San Francisco. And at that time, you know, they had 60,000 people in the stands. You can't just take 60,000 people and go to another stadium, that kind of thing. So, you know, I know they wanted to play it in San Francisco, but, you know, you as a ball player, you play every day. And then back then, that's what we did. We played every day. And to take 10 days off in the middle of a season, it literally, when we came back, it was like spring training all over again. And for me personally, the World Series lost a lot of its luster because of that.
What'd you do in those 10 days? Well, how'd you try
we actually stayed in San Francisco and we worked out at the ballpark, but then we went around the community and helped out, you know, some soup kitchens and you know, places that really had gotten whacked pretty good. On the flip side of things, Oakland went down to Arizona and played their instructional league team. So they actually went down there and started playing games against their instructional league team. But we stayed, you know, in the Bay Area and helped out San Francisco as much as we could.
Very cool.
So, Will, we've got some pitchers. Don't worry. They're safe pitchers. They're internet-friendly pitchers. We're just going to share them, and we're going to ask you some questions on what you were potentially thinking during these moments.
Fire away, Jack.
All right.
These are usually pretty good, Will, depending on – there we go. Looks like a scowl to me.
Yeah, no, so this is two teammates who are teammates on the Olympic team. We've been in spring training and faced each other in spring training 15 times every year. And now I'm on first base in the World Series. He's playing defense. And, you know, I'm like, what the hell's going on, big boy? You know, and this is actually probably game three or game four, one of these. I don't know, because I'm in the home jersey. So I'm like, what the hell did you do for 10 days while we were there at the food kitchen? Where were you at? He was, I'm in Arizona. I was playing all kinds of baseball.
I thought you were going to say, why is your jersey so small?
Yeah, no. I know why it was small. Oh, my God.
So if we go to this one, I couldn't get – it's a little blurry, but this is the best one I can find.
I got it. Don't worry. So Kevin Mitchell – Ozzie Smith hit the ball. Kevin Mitchell's chasing this ball, and you can see where the wall is right there. If you back it up for a few frames, he looked down – to find where the wall was because he knew he was getting close. And when he looked up, he had overrun the ball. And so instead of, like, you know, trying to get his glove up, he just reached with the other hand and the boogie bear, he got him a big old paw full and snagged it, you know, in the air, you know, and actually this was out number three. So he comes into the dugout and everybody's laughing and giggling and howling and he's sitting on the bench, you know, and I'm sitting right next to him. He goes, what's the big deal? I go, dude, I said, nobody bare hands a ball down the line. And he goes, well, I said, I know what you did. You overran it. He goes, yeah. I go, yeah, but you're going to be on every ESPN highlight for the rest of your life. He goes, really? I go, yeah, nobody does this crap.
I remember that catch. Like,
he was
like it was yesterday.
Oh, my God. He was a beauty.
All right. We got one more.
Oh, my God. One of my best friends in baseball. And the reason being, because we couldn't get him out. That's why he was at first base every freaking time. This guy right here, Tony Gwynn, was an absolute stud. He's I credit him with a lot of my success, believe it or not. I would come out and watch him take early batting practice. He would in turn come watch me, and I learned a ton of stuff about hitting, mechanics, what pitches to look for, how to eliminate pitches. I learned it from that man right there, who is flat out one of the best ever.
Gwynn. All right.
That's it?
That's all the pitchers. We gotta get into West Coast swing here.
Well, those are the only internet friendly pictures we could find. So
probably. Okay. So all right. that's the good. All right. So here we go. All right. So you know, a lot of times, you know, and especially when I do like public speaking and stuff like that, a lot of people want to know what goes on the mound. You know, is it like Bull Durham with the candelabras and the fried chicken for Jose and all that? And sometimes it is, sometimes it's real technical, right? So we're in San Diego. I'm not going to tell you who the pitcher is, but we make outs in the top of the first inning. Here comes the bottom of the first inning. We groove one to the leadoff hitter. Whack, homer. I did not know this at the time, but it was one of those military days. It was a day game, right? And so all the military guys are there. So, like, right behind me is the Padres bullpen at the old stadium in Jack Murphy, Qualcomm, whatever you want to call it. And they shoot a freaking cannon. Boom! It scares the hell out of me. I'm like, oh, Jesus. One of these numbers, right? So we get the second guy out. Then here comes Tony Gwynn. We just talked about him. We could never get him out. Lay one in there. Whack! Homer. Boom! They shoot the cannon. All the military guys are going crazy. Third guy comes up, it's Carmelo, I think it's Carmelo Martinez. Lay one in there, whack, homer, boom, shoot the cannon. All the military guys are going crazy, right? So, you know, we're down 3-0. So here comes the pitching coach out to the mound. And when the pitching coach or the manager came out to the mound, we had a rule that all the infielders came out there because we didn't know whether they were going to switch defenses, we need to move around or whatever. And on top of that, I wanted to listen to what the hell they were talking about. So the pitcher is going to be a smartass, and he's going to cut the pitching coach off, and he's going to go, hey, I know, I'm getting the ball up. I'm overstriding. I'm not doing this. I'm not doing that. You know, and me and the ball's right there, and whack-a-hoya, you know. And the pitching coach looks at him. He goes, no, and he points in the dugout. He says, Roger, and talking about Roger Craig, our manager. He says, Roger wanted to give the cannon guy time to reload. So we're on the mound. We're like these numbers, you know. And I'm like, I'm at first base after that, and I look at Robbie Thompson, and I go, I'm still laughing. I can't catch a ground ball right now. And he goes, I can't either.
Seattle, Portland, LA, San Fran, San Diego, Scottsdale, Phoenix. This is Kay Wynn.
And Big Ben.
And we are Western Standard Time. WSD Podcast. We're everywhere online. Podbean, iTunes, Apple Podcast. What do we talk about, Ben?
We got all sports, NBA, NFL, MLB, Pac-12, WCC. If it's on the West Coast, we got you covered.
You know what else we got you covered? A little lifestyle, a little fun, a little banter to lighten up your day. There are 5-minute life guides.
So whether you live in Seattle, Kansas City, Frisco, Texas, Boston, Worcester, Florida, and you love West Coast sports, make sure you follow us, download us. New episode every Friday.
And we're out.
Boom.
Boom.